Good morning, everyone. It is the morning of September 1st, and it looks like it's going to be a great day here in Winnipeg. I'm starting 2 weeks of holidays, which won't really be a holiday too much or overall, because I'll be on my way to California to give a series of talks, to hold a series of gatherings. It will be the opportunity to see some old friends and the opportunity to make some new friends. As always, I want to thank everyone who has sent a question in or sent comments of appreciation, and those who have sent in donations this month. As always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for initially establishing this website and for posting these talks each month and for making this possible in a very direct way. Before we get into the questions that have come in this month, I want to say that if anyone has been tuning in to these question and answer monthly responses, and you're finding it difficult to relate to what's being said, I would suggest that you find the two essential talks that are on this website. They're under the little drop heading talks. One is called Acknowledging the Moment, and the other is called An Overview of Spiritual Awakening. So if you're having difficulty relating to some of my responses in the monthly talks, give a listen to those essential talks on the website. Begin with the overview of spiritual awakening, and then move to acknowledging the moment. And this may give you a better sense of what's being presented here. All right, so let's get down to it. The first person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. How do you define non-duality? Having a non-dual perspective, does a person still experience tensions and conflicts with others? Is it a matter of understanding the non-dual perspective, or is it a matter of experiencing oneness and no separation between oneself and others?" Okay, non-duality is the sense that all of existence, which is just the happening of this moment, the sense that this happening is one great undivided event or dynamic, that it's not divided up into a bunch of stable things, and it's not a matter of a so-called invisible self that's separate from all of these other so-called things. It's just the impression that all of existence, and again, that is just the happening of this moment. This is the only thing that we really have the feeling is existing in this moment. For each of us, there's just the impression that something is happening now, occurring now. And non-duality is the impression or the feeling that this is one big undivided happening. Now, that feeling or impression changes from moment to moment, because all things change from moment to moment. So in certain moments, it can feel as though there is only one big ocean, the ocean of this moment, moving and shifting and dancing. And in other moments, it feels very much as though it's a bunch of separate things to some degree, but there's an underlying impression that that's just not the truth, that it is actually one big event. And if it's considered in detail, you know, it may be that this feeling of one big event is very light. I remember Jiddu Krishnamurti once said that sometimes it's as light as the touch of a spring breeze on your cheek, that sometimes it feels like one big massive ocean in this moment, and it's quite obvious that everything we are is just the moving and shifting of this big ocean. And other times, the sense of this one big movement is that it is, or the sense of this great unexplainable dance, the impression of this great unexplainable dance is that, or is as light as the touch of a spring breeze on your cheek. However, even in those moments where it's as light as the touch of a spring breeze on your cheek, if the situation is examined in great detail, if it's examined very closely, it will be realized in an even stronger way that there is only a totally unexplainable happening presenting itself. Now, is it possible to have that impression of existence and still have tensions and conflicts with others? Absolutely. Because even though there is only a totally unexplainable happening, there is the apparent world of form. And in that apparent world of form, it can be observed or realized that each and every one of us is a unique, an apparently unique form. Even though we aren't ultimately a form at all, our apparent expression is somewhat different from all the other apparent expressions. So each and every apparent form within this great unexplainable happening is a unique expression. And sometimes the differences between these apparent forms is so great that there will be automatic tensions and conflicts. So no two human beings are identical in the same way that no two snowflakes are identical. No two leaves, no two trees, no two human beings have the same breath rate. No two human beings have the same pulse rate. No two human beings have the same skin composition. We don't have the same needs. I mean, we have certain basic needs that seem to be the same, but each of us has certain unique apparent needs, and those are somewhat different from each and every other human being. So when these apparent forms are apparently rubbing up against each other, whether it be in bed or or in a social situation, a party situation or a work situation, or a political situation or a spiritual situation, the differences will very naturally manifest themselves, will very naturally express themselves. And so there will be tensions, apparent tensions and conflicts. But actually the whole thing is a totally unexplainable dynamic that's simply presenting itself. And throughout the centuries, there has been an apparent belief that we could override these differences, that somehow if we just practiced hard enough or developed ourselves enough, that we would overcome these differences and everyone would get along. But of course, after, let's say, 5,000 years of doing this, if I remember correctly, the very first indication of spiritual practices is a stone carving of a yoga practitioner in a meditation pose. And I think that's about 5,000 years old. So after 5,000 years of spiritual practices, have a look around the world and see how many people are getting along. And you tell me if spiritual practices have overcome these differences. So this person has also asked, is it a matter of understanding the non-dual perspective, or is it a matter of experiencing oneness and no separation between oneself and others? Well, if there is a realization of the non-dual perspective, or, you know, sometimes people say the word understanding, the non-dual perspective, there's no possible way to ultimately feel that you are legitimately some separate object from all other beings. However, on a day-to-day basis, it'll still seem like, you know, there are separate human beings. But somehow all of that is couched or contained or held or rests within this underlying sense that it is all simply one big event. So once again, even in those moments where it's not so obvious, if it's considered to any degree, or even if it's not considered to any degree, there is fundamentally this underlying sense or feeling that it is one big unexplainable dynamic, or more accurately or more succinctly, it is an undivided liveliness. Now, again, the feeling of that can shift from moment to moment. So sometimes it's almost like it's an altered state of, there's this incredibly strong feeling in some at certain times that there is only the big vibrant ocean of existence. And at other times it's just this very light underlying sense that no matter what else it seems to be, it is simply a totally unformed, unexplainable dance. All right, second person has written in saying, "Hi Daryl, I am really delighted to have found your site. Your perspective feels wholly refreshing. I, at 66 years of age, marvel more and more at how, since there has never been a noun or a thing or an object particle that has arrested or stopped for even a picosecond, when I look especially at another person, I see how truly exquisite and poignant this all is. Is this then really the ultimate default, that this ceaseless, spontaneous, energetic arising is just pure isness, just ising along ceaselessly? Yet I have experienced practicing the law of attraction, please bear with me a bit, where if I think more positive thoughts or entertain more positive feelings, my experiences do seem more lubricated, easier, better circumstances. I think this can get semantically confused, as perhaps, granted, there is only this evident, energetic, spontaneous arising, and it includes the imagined person practicing this law of attraction thing. Is it all inclusive?" From this non-dual sensibility, yes, it's all inclusive. Even though in any particular situation it may seem as though we're causing something to happen. Once again, if you enter the world of cause and effect, you can't just take two small items in the chain of cause and effect and say that that's the chain of cause and effect. Because if you do, a particular cause seems to end up being the primary cause, and it's not the primary cause. A particular thing seems to be the primary cause, and that isn't the primary cause in the chain of cause and effect. Whatever cause we find has its own cause, and that will eventually come back to the great unformed event of the universe or existence. So that's the actual chain of cause and effect. So if we look at this situation that this person has referred to, the law of attraction, whereby he's inclined to think more positive thoughts or entertain more positive feelings, and it seems as though life is more easygoing as a result. So there's the feeling that he has caused this. However, if we just look at this in a very simple way, simply acknowledge what we already know to be the cause or the chain of cause and effect, we can realize that this urge, this interest in thinking more positive thoughts or entertaining more positive feelings, these are not created by us. Either we have that kind of inclination or we don't. So within this viewpoint of the world of cause and effect, we are not the primary cause of our own being. We are not the cause of a brain and a body. We are not the cause of how a brain and a body works. So therefore, we're not the cause of our apparent actions. There is something much larger at work here. So, if we relate to the notion of cause and effect, we can realize that we're not the primary cause of existence, not even the primary cause of our own existence. And if we relate to an even more subtle sense of the happening of this moment, we can realize that if we sit and we do absolutely nothing, if we make no effort to do anything, the particular urges that we have present themselves. What we call the urge to live life in a certain way, that simply presents itself without any effort on our part. So the apparent efforts that we make to do certain things in life, those are the urge to make those efforts are compulsive. And even if we wanted to sit in a room and do absolutely nothing for the rest of our lives, that wouldn't happen. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there who will have the compulsion to to try to sit in a room for the rest of their lives and do absolutely nothing, and they may be compulsively expressed to the point that they end up apparently dying as a result. But that isn't going to be the case for most of us. That's a rare compulsion within existence. That would be a rare expression of existence. However, for the so-called average person, even if we wanted to sit and do absolutely nothing for the rest of our lives, we would find ourselves compelled to go to the toilet, compelled to go get something to eat, compelled to leave the room, compelled to go out and associate with our friends. It's quite funny, this sense that we're in charge, because I remember there was a time back in the days when I apparently was a Buddhist monk, and I was a teaching monk, and I taught meditation. And in that format, that approach, even though meditation was simply an approach to exploring existence, when I was apparently presenting this approach of meditation, people would say, "I can't possibly sit still for longer than 2 seconds. Like, there's no possible way that I can sit still." And so, you know, that was interesting. But what's amusing is that now, when I say to people, if you sit down and do absolutely nothing, make no effort whatsoever, you'll discover that everything is a compulsive movement. Now people say to me, "Oh, I can't even attempt to sit down and do absolutely nothing, because if I do, I'll sit there for the rest of my life." and I'll do nothing. I'll just become catatonic. I won't make any effort at all. When very quickly you'll discover that that's not true. You won't be sitting there ceaselessly. Although for some people, for some apparent people, they may be drawn to a very restful existence in that sitting. And for many people, they find that actually a very joyous happening, just sitting quietly. It's not that they're compelling themselves to sit quietly, and it's not that they've lost interest in life. It's just that they are compelled, they are inclined to rest in that quietude. Is quietude an actual word? Rest in that, just rest. And others will be inclined to think positive thoughts and entertain more positive feelings. All right, third person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, still enjoying so much your monthly talks and the clarity of your answers. My question is, unlike watching an engrossing movie or in the process of reading an exciting book, there is the feeling that there is something like a frame of reality, subtle, that is surrounding these experiences. I feel the body on the chair and the popcorn in my hands. But frequently, to put it mildly, when I walk from the kitchen to the bedroom, or while cooking a meal or shopping in the market, automatic chores and movements, that sense is gone, like waking from a sleep, and there seems to be a blank space of nothing with no memory of what happened in between. I am not nuts, nor has senility taken over entirely. But I'm curious as to what is going on in these blank spaces. Life is good, and your thoughts and comments in your books are great bookends to my day. With love and gratitude." Okay. I can't ultimately say what's actually going on in this situation. But within the world of form and the usual descriptions that we have of existence, or the descriptions that have arisen in apparent history, if we apparently become more comfortable with the happening of the moment, if we're resting as the happening of the moment, there can occur what traditionally has been known as states of concentration, or they become more obvious. Within Buddhism, they're called jhanic states. Within the yoga tradition, the word is dhyana. So the word jhana is just a variation of the word dhyana. And within Zen traditions, the original word Zen was Chinese, it's Chan, and Chan is a variation of jhana, and Zen is a variation of Chan. So we have, just generally, these words all point to what are known as concentrated states or altered states. Now, usually, if the apparent focus, if our apparent attention is tightly focused on the world of form and the world of explanation, that gives the impression of a general feeling of life being an explainable event, a world of form that's explainable. However, if this has been explored to some degree and there is more a sense of the moment simply being a totally unexplainable happening, and the focus, that tight attention, is not directed toward the world of form and the world of explanation, then it can give a different feeling It can have, you know, literally what we would call a different physical feeling of the moment. So if we look at the various concentration practices of the various meditation traditions, we have this stepping away from a tight focus on the world of thought. At first, it's a stepping away from the tight focus on the world of thought. And it comes to the actual physical event of the moment, a focus on the physical forms. But then if there is a stepping back from the tight focus on the world of form to the actual event of each form, then that sense of formedness falls away and it becomes more a sense of vibration and pulsation and just an unformed event. Now, within the various traditions, there's an exploration of certain subtle forms, certain subtle ideas or interpretations of existence. And so, within these various traditions, they begin exploring the notion that this event is somehow housed or contained in something called consciousness. But then as we explore that to some degree, or to a great degree, apparently explore it, there can be the realization that there is nothing there that we can call consciousness. Like, we don't actually experience a container called consciousness. So there's a feeling of nothingness. And so the focus goes on an interpretation of nothingness. Now, nothingness, I mean, there's nothing there to actually experience. And so with further exploration, there may be the feeling of just, there is this pure happening of the moment, pure being. And within certain traditions, that interpretation gets challenged because there can be the realization that nothing actually is being. There is a vibrant dance that has no particular form. So there is no ongoing being of anything. There's just a totally unformed event. And when we start to challenge that notion, that very subtle interpretation of being, then we come to the areas of what we would call realization, in which case there isn't any longer any attempt to interpret existence, or there isn't any belief that it can be interpreted. The apparent words, the apparent interpretations still arise, but there's no focus on that as an absolute truth or as a truth of any kind, really. It's just a functional tool in this mysterious happening. Now, all of that can apparently be done within a meditation tradition, that kind of exploration. But it's also the case that if we just simply start to acknowledge that life is one big event, we can experience some of these altered states, so that if there's no longer any huge desire or need to interpret existence, and there is instead simply a resting, a feeling that we are this automatic, spontaneous dance of existence, and there isn't any need to define it, then in certain situations where it's pretty routine situations, the attention just doesn't go on defining the moment. And there can be these situations where everything takes place, but no storyline has been produced. And so all of a sudden it just feels like, well, what just happened there? I don't have a storyline for that. And that's it. Literally, you don't have a storyline for that because no storyline was needed. It's just a totally mysterious event presenting itself. Now, this, you know, this shifting around of attention, that goes on all the time. So people don't realize it, but they're going in and out of jhanic states all the time. And it's just that they're not sustained long enough to make themselves obvious. But occasionally, the average person has this kind of experience. So you may be having great sex, and the event becomes much more important than any definition of it. And so there's this feeling of the larger event of existence. It's like an actual physical feeling that life is just this larger undefined dance. Or we may be walking through a park one day on a sunny day, and all of a sudden the focus on thoughts and feelings and our personal history, that falls away. And instead, the sunshine, the laughter of children, the joy of moving the body, all of that makes itself more obvious. And so, once again, there is this sense of this larger event, and there isn't any urge to define it. So the definitions fall away, and there is what seems to be a physical feeling of this larger event of existence. And that makes itself obvious, and in most cases, immediately, there is this response of, what's that? What's that? I want that. That's incredible. I need to have that. And so a lot of the time what happens is there's some kind of urge to get back to that state by making it happen, when in fact it was just letting all the doing and the describing fall away, and the larger event of the moment made itself obvious. So it, you know, in my own case, when I'm presenting these responses, you know, there's a reading of the question, and then there's a response that comes. And at the end of these sessions, I can't remember anything that was said, because it just comes out. There isn't any kind of mulling it over. There's just the happening, and there's no need to have a storyline regarding the happening. It just happens. So usually at the end of these sessions, I end up having to play this back to get some sense of what was actually said. So once again, these so-called altered states, or jhanic states, or chan states, or dhyana states, they can apparently occur within a very traditional exploration of a meditation tradition and apparent meditation practices, or they can also spontaneously occur in just this consideration that life is this greater unformed happening. In this consideration, the underlying urge to constantly focus on a storyline and the underlying need to have a description of existence, that falls away. So that in certain apparent routine situations, there isn't any inclination to describe it at all. The event just takes place. And then it seems like a moment later, it's like, oh, what happened there? It seems like there's a blank space. But it was just life expressing itself without any urge to have a storyline. All right, another person has written in saying, Hi, Daryl. Living in society, I learned to put masks on my face, smiling when I don't feel like it, being too nice, and many times being a hypocrite, pretending to be better than I am. In the past, I tried being more real to my feelings and ended up being in conflict with people around me. This week, this dualistic view about essence and personality has arisen again. Personality is what I learned to be, and essence is what I am to myself. How do you resolve this philosophical conflict between these two parts of our being? Thank you for your teachings. Now, this person has sent in some additional information. It turns out that these two terms, personality and essence, he's basically taking from a talk given by Osho, who was using the terms personality and individuality. So Osho, and for anyone who doesn't know, Osho is Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. They started calling him Osho, I think, after he passed away. Osho was saying that individuality is that which you have brought from your birth, and personality is what society has been trying to train you to be. So individuality is your essential being, and personality is what society has made of you, what they wanted to make of you. Now, this person has asked how I would reconcile these two portions of my being. So I don't really have to reconcile these two portions of my being, my apparent being, because I don't acknowledge there are two portions to my apparent being. So there is only essence. There is only a totally unexplainable happening presenting itself. Now, if we go into explanations, we will eventually be faced with a story that's saying, oh, when I was born, I was so pure, and society has somehow defiled that purity, and now I can't figure out what my true being actually is. What a non-dual perspective is pointing to is the fact that when we apparently came out of the womb, for every one of us, there wasn't any explanation of existence at all. There was no storyline. And there was no feeling of being someone who was actually doing existence. So if we look at a baby that's 1 hour old, the baby isn't attempting to manipulate existence in any way. The baby is simply open to the entire happening of the moment. The baby is the happening of the moment. There's no focus on forms. There is no storyline. The arms and legs move. The head bobs around. The feet kick. All of that is just the movement of existence. The baby automatically suckles at its mother's breast. The baby can't even find a breast. It can't identify a breast. But if the mother holds the baby to the breast, the baby automatically suckles. The baby isn't thinking, oh, here's my mother's breast and I need to suckle in order to have food. It's all on automatic. There is just this event. The baby didn't decide to leave the womb. The baby didn't decide when it was out of the womb, apparently out of the womb. The baby didn't decide to grow larger. The baby didn't decide to begin walking. The baby didn't decide to begin talking or thinking. All of this is simply the automatic movement of nature or existence or whatever you want to call it, the universe, the great spirit. It doesn't really matter to me. Now, somewhere along the line, this odd impression starts that we are directing our development, that we are directing our life. So we don't think that a snowflake is directing its life. We don't think that a bear is directing its life. We don't think that your pet cat is directing its life. We have the impression that the cat has certain urges given by nature, and it ultimately follows those urges. It has certain abilities. It has a certain lack of abilities. But all of it is just simply an expression of nature, the universe, the great spirit, the unformed ocean of existence, the river of life. But for some reason we have this very strange sense that we are creating our own urges, that we create our abilities, that we create our lack of abilities, that we create our needs, our interests, our concerns. And that simply isn't true. And for anyone who considers it, it's not true. So within this situation, this odd situation, for some reason, and who knows what's going on here, it seems as though apparently we start thinking we're in charge of life and that we somehow decide how we're going to behave as individuals. And somehow, when we get a whole group of ourselves together, we decide what society is going to be and do. And so this ultimately leads to some weird story about a baby that's born pure and somehow it's defiled by society. It's defiled by its parents and the way they brought the child up. The child is defiled by the educational system, and the child is defiled by society. And we can end up disliking our mother and father, disliking the educational system, disliking society, and being at war with all of this and all of what society has offered, thinking that somehow they've really messed us up. But from a non-dual sensibility, none of that is true. If we, as apparent individuals, if we are not directing the course of our life, then society isn't directing the course of our life either, because society is simply made up of a number of apparent individuals. And society can only be what it is in any particular moment, and whatever it is automatically moving on to some other expression. And yes, within the world of apparent form and the world of stories, we can make up this story that somehow a human being is separate from all the other human beings in society, and society somehow gathers together to influence the movement of that individual. From a non-dual sensibility, that's not true. The so-called individual and the so-called society, all of that is a totally mysterious event. Now, if we buy into the storyline, if we believe that storyline, if we focus on that storyline, we're left with this conflict. We're left with the feeling that somehow society has defiled what we are, our pure nature. It's being defiled by society. But society is pure nature too. And so if we're in this conflict, if we're trying to sort this out through the storylines, we find ourselves in an endless battle. How has society contaminated me? And how am I going to throw that out of my purity so I can go back to being pure? But whatever you are in any moment is the natural and pure expression of essence, of existence itself, the universe, the great spirit, the unformed ocean, the river of life. All of that is a totally unexplainable, unformed happening. A moving, shifting, dancing event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. There isn't anything separate from that, influencing that, or defiling that. So, from this non-dual perspective, in any particular moment, you will have to be whatever you are. And it doesn't matter what you think your explanations, or what the explanations are for that. Those explanations are not true. There is simply a moving, shifting, dancing event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. You are a compelled movement of that event, because you're not anything separate from it. You are that event itself. And it will simply do whatever it does in any particular moment. If we look at something like the Ashtavakra Gita, there's a line in there which says that someone who ends up acting without knowing why it is they act, that so-called person is free. They have another line in there that states, it's as though they move like a leaf blowing in the wind. Now, the leaf doesn't have an explanation for its movement. It is just moving. It is just shifting with the urges of the wind. And so it is that we have Christ saying, the wind blows wherever it blows. You can't know where it's coming from, and you can't know where it's going to. And it's exactly the same for everything born of spirit. Now, within the storylines, there is the feeling that we are manipulating existence, that we're in control to some degree, and that we're going, either we're going in the wrong direction or we're going in the right direction. And if we're going in the wrong direction, that's our fault. And if we're going in the right direction, that's our credit. We should get the praise for that. But from a non-dual perspective, none of that makes any sense. There is only a totally unexplainable happening, like the wind blowing. It's just blowing. It's just happening. There's nothing to understand, ultimately. There's nothing to describe, ultimately. It's just a totally unexplainable event. Now, I don't know what any particular teacher, what their sense of existence ultimately is, but if somebody's telling you that you need to throw out everything that society has ever put upon you, they're just causing you a lot of grief that's unnecessary. Or actually, it is necessary, because if that's what they're saying, that's the only thing they're capable of saying. And within a non-dual sensibility, you throw out everything that anybody has ever said, because ultimately there's the realization that there is only a totally unexplainable event. Now, that doesn't leave you feeling as though, you're not left never having a thought about being an individual or never having a thought about society and its influence upon you. It's just that those storylines are embraced by a larger realization that the storyline isn't true, that there is only a totally unexplainable happening. The dance of the universe, the unformed ocean of existence, the flowing of the river of life, the unformed, the asankhata, the great spirit, God, Brahma, whatever you want to call it is fine with me, but it's these words all simply point to this indefinable dynamic that this moment actually is. We can't even call it this moment. There's no need to call it an inexplicable dynamic. This just points to the event. There is this event of this moment. And the apparent storylines are simply a portion of the event. They are also a compelled movement. But all of that is a totally unexplainable happening. So there's no need to reconcile two portions of your personality, because there aren't any two portions of your personality. The storyline that says there are two portions of your personality, or that there is your individuality and your personality, and one is your purity and the other is the defilement of society, that's fantasy from a non-dual perspective. All of this is simply for your consideration. I'm not saying that this is the one true way of looking at existence. I'm just saying, here's another possible perspective. If you relate to it, that's wonderful. And if you don't, that's wonderful. Either way is fine. All right. Another person has written in saying, what's your take on the current politics in the USA? Thanks, Daryl. Namaste. Well, from this non-dual perspective, I mean, I just expressed what my take on the politics in the USA, what my sense of that is. It's a totally unexplainable event happening the way it's happening. And within the storylines, yes, there's a lot of craziness. There's a lot of strangeness. More than anything else, One of the most interesting things I find about this event that we call the politics of the USA, if we look at the current expressions of the president and the various individuals wanting to become president, everyone is giving the impression that they are either in control of the situation at the moment, or that if they got the chance, they could take total control of the situation and just correct all of the difficulties. When in fact, if we examine the situation, the economic situation in the United States right at the moment, there isn't anybody in control. Actually, if we go into the storyline, we'll discover that the United States right at the moment is needing to pump more money into its economic system. So it's having its treasury print treasury bonds, and they're attempting to sell that, those on the open market. But because most of the investors don't trust the economic situation in the United States, no one is buying the treasury bonds. So what the United States Treasury is doing is then printing more money, and then the U.S. government is buying the treasury bonds and making it look as though they're being bought by outside investors. So basically they're spending $3 in order to make $2, and this makes no sense whatsoever. So upon, upon a simple examination within the world of form, a simple examination of the apparent storylines, this situation doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's not a matter of anything being led by wise individuals. It's simply a matter of a situation that's totally compulsive. It's compelled. And it's presenting itself the way it's presenting itself. The whole world in this moment seems to be shifted from its usual norm. And it's kind of, it's all looking a bit wacky right at the moment. And who knows how that's going to settle out. It will settle to some degree, apparently, at some point. But how this is all going to settle out, who knows? Basically, the United States and its position as the world power that it once was, that has shifted. And now there are other apparent nations that will become the world power, simply through the economics of the whole situation, the apparent economics of the whole situation. You know, it's also the case that they lay blame, you know, they're saying Obama is to blame for the economic situation of the moment, which is totally absurd. I mean, it started a few presidents ago, and it's playing out the way it plays out, and so now Obama gets blamed for it, and the people who are blaming Obama say that they could take total control, but of course, if they are apparently elected, they will end up finding themselves totally helpless in this situation as well. It will play out in whatever way it plays out. And one thing we shouldn't ignore is the fact that within those storylines, this whole thing is pretty scary. But the fact remains that existence is a great mysterious dance. At one point, like India used to have some marvelous symbols for this dance, and you would have a figure like Mother Kali giving birth to her children, basically, and then devouring them alive. And this was meant to be a very direct representation of existence or God or the ocean of existence, the river of life, the Asankhata, the Tao. It was great, it was fierce, it was unexplainable. And the only place of rest within that event was the realization that we're a portion of the event. No matter what occurs, there is only this great mysterious event, and it doesn't stop in its expression. It just expresses itself in different ways. And in this moment, we are apparently one of its expressions. But at some point, we, you know, the so-called individuals that we are, those move on to a different expression. But we don't ever stop being that dance. When is existence going to end? When is existence itself, the universe, God, Atman, when is that going to end? And there's no way of thinking of that in terms of ending, because it's existence itself. It's the dance of whatever this is. It's beyond explanation. It's beyond ideas of beginning and ending. It's just a totally mysterious happening. And we don't exist as anything apart from that. Okay, another person has written in saying, Daryl, I very much appreciate your ability to describe as best as anyone can the indescribable. I was wondering, since you were with Ajahn Sumedho for some years, you must have been exposed to his teachings on the sound of silence. I have heard this ongoing high-pitched vibration for years and have come to associate it with the flow of energy that is this apparent body-mind. Do you have any perspective on this sound? Now, for anyone who's not familiar with it, what's known as the sound of silence, or within the yoga traditions, it's called the nada. And within certain yoga traditions, like Laya Yoga, the yoga of sound, it's known as the true Om. So this sound of silence, even the average person, if they're out in the countryside, far away from all of the usual sounds of the city and all the usual noises of television, radio, and all the rest of it, that in moments of incredible silence, there is kind of a high-pitched ringing that some people experience. It could be like the sound of 1,000 insects, but it's not insects. It could be, for some, it's like a distant jet engine kind of continually revving and lessening. Or it could be like a high-pitched electrical sound. Now, within the world of meditation traditions, this is known as the sound of silence, or as I pointed out, it's called the nada. And within certain traditions, it's known as the true Om. So within Laya Yoga, which is a very esoteric form of yoga, it would be a yoga of chanting, a yoga of sound. You would have, you would begin by using a mantra, the word Om, and you would say that out loud in one of their practices, and at a certain point you would stop saying it out loud, you would say it internally, and this would kind of disrupt the usual thoughts of existence until the thoughts were actually quite quiet. This inclination to repeat this mantra will be accompanied at some point by the lessening of the thought patterns, and all of this takes place in a very special set of circumstances, and it's only for those that are compelled to explore in that way or compelled to be that expression. But within that situation, at some point, you stop internally repeating the word Om, and what's left in that incredible silence is this sound of silence, this high-pitched electrical sound, this sound of 1,000 distant insects, or the sound of what might seem to be a distant jet engine for some. And that's known as the true Om, the basic sound of existence itself. Now, I have no idea what that is. In my apparent expression, I've had to live with that from the time I was about 12. And it's still very much in this moment that's going on. And I often wonder if it's what the sound specialists or the hearing specialists call tinnitus, but tinnitus is supposed to be some bothersome malfunction of the hearing, and I don't find this bothersome in any way. It's just always been one of the expressions of existence. So within the storylines, some people say it's the sound of the synaptic firing of the cells. Some say it's the sound of the blood flowing through the inner ear. I have no idea what it is, but for many people, it's a very obvious expression of existence and will be for the course of their apparent lives. That's all I can really comment on with regard to this sound of silence. Another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I'm writing in case you haven't got enough questions for the month, and to say that I find your perspective really funny." I hope he means amusing and not strange. If you do need a question to pad out the program, I would ask, when you talk about the event of this moment, do you see this event as being timeless? Just in general, yes. Actually, let's be more specific. Let's say the words time and timeless don't apply to this event. So anyone, if they wish to acknowledge their experience of life very clearly, would have to acknowledge that all they ever experience in their so-called waking reality is the happening of the present moment. Now, I don't know anybody who has the experience that, or who feels as though they're living in 1930, or who feels as though they're living in the 1700s. You can think about the 1700s, you can think about the 1930s, but those thoughts are occurring in a very basic feeling that we call the present moment. We can think about a future, but everyone in general has the sensibility that those thoughts are occurring now. Our basic sense of existence is the feeling that something is happening now, something is occurring now. And that somehow, that nowness has more of a feeling of reality than thoughts about the past and thoughts about the future. So if we're going to acknowledge what we call our actual existence, it has to be the feeling of now, the present moment. And that's all we've ever experienced, because if we consider what's happened in the past, when that was actually happening, it had the feeling it was happening now. And if we think about the future, we have the impression that those thoughts are happening now, and we know that if that particular future situation comes, it will feel like it's happening now. So really, all we've ever experienced is this feeling of something happening right now. And that's ultimately indefinable. When that presents itself, initially, or apparently presents itself initially, there isn't any storyline that comes with it. So this happening of now isn't even something we can call the happening of now. It's just this. And storylines, and that includes the storylines about time and timelessness, those don't apply to this. Whatever this is, yeah, this is it. Moving on here, another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, some teachers see awakening as the turning of the attention from objects toward itself. Is that possible? Can awareness be aware of awareness? If we take it as that which knows objects. Well, if we talk about awareness and we talk about awareness being that which knows objects, yes, it can make itself its own object. However, that storyline doesn't apply. Because basically, if awareness makes itself an object of itself, if we look at our own experience, what we find is there's this basic happening of the moment. And that gets divided up into various forms and labeled with various sounds. So basically we talk about this fundamental awareness as seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, and thinking. Now, if we take any one of those segments, let's take seeing. We have this happening that we call seeing. It's just this event that we call seeing, the big event that we call seeing. Now, seeing is what we would call basic awareness, part of what we would call basic awareness. If the focus goes from that event that we call seeing and focuses on one portion of that event, a so-called object, now we call that shape an object of seeing, an object of awareness. But it's the same event. It's just the intellect dividing up the event into different portions and giving it different names. It's not two things. It's not seeing and an object of seeing. It's just one event, and if it's not labeled or divided intellectually, it's just a happening that has no definition. It has no particular form. The happening that we call seeing is always moving on to something else. And in one moment, the seeing may have the feeling of predominance, but in another moment, the hearing is predominant. And in another moment, the basic sense of touching is predominant. And in another moment, the basic sense of tasting is predominant. This happening that we call awareness has no particular form. It's moving and shifting. It's this nebulous event. Now, if we step back from that storyline and just come to acknowledge that when any of us came out of the womb, basically there is just this event presenting itself. There is no storyline. Even the story that we're coming out of a womb doesn't exist. There's just a totally mysterious event. There is no storyline. And if we acknowledge that the storylines, the labels, are just sounds attached to forms, and if we acknowledge that all the forms are changing, then we have meaningless sounds attached to forms that don't ultimately exist, and therefore we're outside of even the consideration that any of this is something called awareness or something called consciousness. So no, from a non-dual perspective, awareness can't be aware of awareness. So if we go back to something like the Ashtavakra Gita, again, towards the end of the Ashtavakra Gita, they start negating all of the descriptions, and ultimately they're saying there isn't any duality and there isn't any non-duality. They're ultimately saying there isn't any awareness, there isn't any consciousness, there's no way of defining what this is. So they're saying that even in sleep, there isn't sleep. In awakening, there isn't awakening. In thinking, there isn't any real thinking. In feeling, there isn't any real feeling. They're pointing out that ultimately there's just this happening. In their case, within the Ashtavakra Gita, they point to something called the Absolute. And they're just saying descriptions don't apply to the happening of this moment, to the unformed ocean of existence. Now, this person has also sent in another question. It says, some people are born crippled. Is there a stream of mental consciousness moving from one life to another, causing one person to be reborn to a rich, loving family, another to be reborn to a dysfunctional one? Does a Hitler reap what he sows? Thank you. Within the storylines, within the fantasies, there is this basic notion of forms and the labeling of forms, apparently. And there is the notion of cause and effect. So even if we stay within the storyline of cause and effect, and we ask the question, is there a stream of mental consciousness moving from one life to another, causing one person to be reborn to a rich, loving family and another to be reborn to a dysfunctional one? Within the storylines, yes, you could come up with that story. However, within the storylines and within the world of cause and effect, you could also trace cause and effect back to the moments that there wasn't any consciousness. Because within the storylines, consciousness would come with creatures. It would come with human beings. And at some point, if we trace the notion of cause and effect back to the early portions of the life of the planet Earth, there aren't any human beings. And it's the particular conditions of the planet Earth that give rise to the human possibility, the possibility of human consciousness. Now, underlying that is the particular arrangement of the laws of the universe. That's what gives rise to the planet Earth and its apparent situation. So even within the storyline of cause and effect, the whole thing is simply the expression of the universe. And that, the universe, is really, once again, beyond explanation. Any of the physicists will tell us that their explanations aren't really the truth. They're simply a way of approaching the universe in order to function. So whether you stay within the storyline of cause and effect or whether you step outside the stories, which are just simply meaningless sounds attached to forms that don't actually exist, in either case, we're left with a totally indefinable happening. The universe, which literally translated means undivided turning, or the dance of the Great Spirit, the unformed ocean of existence, the Asankhita, the Tao, God, Brahma, Atman, Krishna. These are all ultimately the indefinable dance of existence. And that's the basis of what we call existence. So the storylines are not the truth. In either case, the storylines are not the truth. What is beyond those storylines. The way off the wheel of karma is to realize that the whole notion of karma is a fantasy. There is no other way out of the wheel of karma, the apparent wheel of karma. Another person has written in saying, Dear Daryl, wishing, hoping, dreaming, finding some solace in stories, beliefs, seeking meaning in the continuing and constant thought streams, some source of control, some technique, and knowing they are all not true. That leaves me feeling stripped to my bones, and even they are not true. Where's the juice in non-duality? Where's the juice in non-duality? I've had a couple of people use this word juice in the last little while. So obviously they're looking for a bit of pizzazz, something exciting that they can hang on to. they're looking for something that would be as exciting as their romantic stories, and a non-dual sensibility strips you of that. But ultimately, what's left is a totally mysterious dance, a great adventure, a great event that's constantly surprising. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that the dance of existence is always moving and shifting. It never expresses itself the same way twice. So there will be moments where life seems very juicy and very exciting. And there can be that bliss-filled feeling of being the unformed dance of existence, the great ocean moving and shifting. And there can be the adventure of what's coming next. Is the next breath actually going to come because we're not doing it? Is the next thought going to come because we're not doing it? Is the next emotion going to come because we're not doing it? And basically, what is coming next because we're not doing it? It can move in a way that's totally unpredictable. And so the juiciness of that event, it's like a massive entertainment system. Sight, sound, touch, taste, smell, all of it, you know, thought, moving, shifting, dancing, having its own current, expressing itself in little surprises all of the time and in big surprises once in a while. So that can seem very juicy at times. And then at other times, it just seems pretty ordinary. Well, it's just, here's the river. It's just kind of meandering along. Doesn't seem to be anything special. And in fact, ultimately, within a non-dual perspective, I mean, there would be this moving to rest. So the focus isn't so much on trying to find and maintain some juicy excitement or juicy storyline. It's more just resting with the adventure, resting as the adventure of life, resting as this indefinable, lively, warming, cooling, sounding, silencing, lightening, darkening, pulsing, vibrating, whatever, just this happening. To me, that has a subtle sense of juiciness. I don't know what it's going to have for you. The sense of it somehow being less than the old views of control and storylines, that's still an emphasis on the storylines and not an acknowledgement of the indefinable dance. And that's fine. One thing to keep in mind throughout all of this, a non-dual sensibility isn't offering you the chance to define your existence. It's not offering you the chance to create your existence, to create the ultimate expression of your existence. It's simply pointing out that all of this has never been anyone's personal doing. And whatever has been juicy and not so juicy has never been your doing. It is playing out in whatever way it plays out. As it says in the Bible, this isn't set up for you to get a reward for your behavior. It's set up for one purpose only, to show that God's in charge. Now, I don't particularly care for that way of expressing it, but another way of saying it is, it's the realization that there is only the unformed ocean. There never was a you in charge of anything. Now, maybe you don't like that one either, so let's call it the river of life, the Tao. Let's call it the unformed flow of nature. And nature, I mean, for some, the world of nature has a miraculous quality to it. So there are lots of expressions of nature that we don't care for. If you're swimming off the coast of Australia and you run across a coral snake, that's maybe not so pleasant. It'll have lots of juice to it. But yeah, nature is fierce at times. Nature is dull at times. Nature is exciting at times. Nature is frightening at times. Nature is calm and soothing at times. All of it is a great mysterious dance. And we're not moving it. Now, yeah, I considered splitting this up into two portions, but I only have two questions left, so I'm just going to continue. This will make this session a fairly long session, but such is life. So another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I very much appreciate your monthly Q&A recordings as well as your books, which I love to read and reread. Your articulation of the non-dual perspectives always leave me open to the mystery of the moment. I'm not sure if there is a question in here, but let's see. Since contemplating this non-dual perspective, I have felt a huge burden drop away. Feelings of confusion, loneliness, indecision, hesitation are seen not as personal faults, but as the expressions of nature, just as much expressions of nature as feelings of clarity, unity, conviction, and confidence. There seems no reason to take life personally. In this recognition, there is no cause for guilt or shame. Personal idiosyncrasies and quirks can now be appreciated and even celebrated. Apparent flaws and weaknesses are part of the divine expression and are not reasons for self-diminishment. I have always had a very shy, quiet, and introspective disposition, and often felt awkward and inadequate because of this. But no matter how hard I tried to be extroverted, gregarious, and exuberant, it seems I could never be expressed any differently than how I was. Now I feel more at ease with how life expresses me, and there appears to be much less of a struggle to be any different. It certainly is much less exhausting this way. I often find it difficult to give reasons for why I apparently make certain decisions when it seems that the decisions are being made out of the flow of countless conditions as they present themselves. I find myself expressing reasons for taking a certain course of action as if that action was my personal doing, yet somehow knowing that decisions and actions are part of the universal and impersonal movement of life. The idea of personal responsibility often seems strange. After all, we don't feel that a bird is responsible for the song that it sings. It can't help but sing its song. We don't blame the rain for falling. It cannot help its falling. Why should our thoughts, actions, decisions, and emotions be any different? This leads me to consider the following. If I appear to hurt another person through my apparent actions or speech, it seems likely that I will feel a sense of remorse and be moved to make amends, even though upon reflection it seems that I could not have acted otherwise under those particular circumstances at that particular time. This suggests to me that even the feeling of remorse and the subsequent movement to make amends is also an expression of the totality of life. Any comments regarding this would be greatly appreciated. Warmest regards." Yeah, that's beautifully expressed. So let's look at some of the things here. This person is saying that he or she finds it difficult to give reasons for why they apparently make certain decisions, because it's obvious that life is simply moving in the way it moves. Now, yes, as it says in the Ashtavakra Gita, when you can get to the point of acting without knowing why you're acting, when you can get to the point, and I mean, to get to that simply means realizing that you don't have any real explanation for why you're acting a certain way. I mean, you can give an explanation, but that's not really why anything's happening. What's happening is just a totally indefinable event expressing itself. And this can be realized from a very simple acknowledgement of our ordinary everyday experience. So, yes, as it says in the Ashtavakra Gita, you find yourself, you know, the realized individual, the realized person moves like a leaf blowing in the wind. There isn't any explanation for it. It's just a physical event. Things move the way they move. Or maybe, you know, an even more succinctly put phrase would be Christ saying, the wind blows wherever it blows. Christ isn't even giving you the chance of being a leaf. You're just part of the wind moving the way it moves. There's nothing to describe. It's just this happening. So, yes, in this situation where it seems as though we may have hurt someone, and automatically we feel remorse for our apparent actions, and there is this urge to make amends for our apparent actions, our apparent speech that may have hurt someone. All of that simply arises with very naturally within this storyline. That's the way the storyline presents itself. Now, in general, if we apparently hurt someone, if it seems as though we've hurt someone, there is an urge to make amends. This isn't true in all apparent expressions. So you have certain apparent individuals that they don't feel remorse. They don't feel any urge to make amends for their actions. So we have what we label as sociopaths and psychopaths. And they are also a natural expression of this larger event. So even if those storylines arise, it can be acknowledged that within the storyline, the feeling that we've hurt someone and the urge to make amends, that isn't our creation. That is simply the movement of nature, or we could call it a gift of nature, or we're expressed by nature in this way. And depending on how nature expresses us, there may be the subsequent action to make amends for apparently hurting someone. And in other situations, the feeling of remorse isn't that strong in order to provoke the action to make amends. And in some cases, there isn't even the feeling of remorse. And all of that's on automatic. All of that is the spontaneous, organic dance of existence. So, you know, in reading this person's expression, this is a very clear and sensitive acknowledgement of the larger dance of existence. And they are very naturally acknowledging that what seems to be a person in conflict is not a person in conflict. It's the unconflicted movement of the river of life. So it's not a person feeling conflicted ultimately over their apparent actions and how they've hurt somebody with an urge to make amends and to wipe out the conflict, the internal conflict. That's not really what's going on here, even if that's what the storyline, the apparent storyline, presents. The storyline can't actually say what's going on here, and even the storyline itself, you know, we're not making any effort to come up with these storylines. The storylines themselves are simply the spontaneous dance of this unexplainable happening. The storylines, even though they apparently have a story to them, all of that is a totally unexplainable happening. So, this person is acknowledging that fact, that all of this is simply the flowing, moving, shifting, dancing event of existence, or the Great Spirit, whatever you want to call it, and that none of it is ultimately conflicted. So, as it points out in the Ashtavakra Gita, it's saying that someone who's realized is not thinking even when it seems like they're thinking, is not asleep even when it seems like they're asleep, is not awake even when it seems like they're awake, that these descriptions don't apply. And so, the awakened one the apparent awakened one, the so-called realized individual, is not conflicted even when in conflict. It points out, the Ashtavakra Gita points out, that the realized one does not see himself or herself as being concentrated or scattered in thought or acting in any kind of immoral way or moral way, that all of this is beyond explanation. It's simply the moving, shifting, dancing event of this great unformed ocean. And so this person who's written in, because there is a sensitive acknowledgement of how life actually presents itself, is acknowledging that even in these situations where we feel conflicted over our behavior, that's not really what's going on. Excuse me. All of that is the great mysterious dance of existence. And it's simply playing out in whatever way it plays out. We're not ultimately going to get the possibility of wiping out the unpleasant, the apparently unpleasant situations. There is the possibility, perhaps, of realizing that what we call unpleasant situations, they're not really unpleasant situations. They're something that can't be explained in any way at all. But that won't get rid of the apparent discomfort of those situations. And so it will move from situations of comfort to situations of apparent discomfort, from situations of apparent clarity to situations of apparent confusion, always moving, shifting, and dancing. All of that without any actual explanation. And last but not least, someone has written in saying, "Daryl, my question is to do with UG Krishnamurti. In his recorded words, he reports that at the age of 49, he went through a calamity where his experiencing structure broke down and the entire culture was flushed out of him. It was a painful event, but certain chemical changes resulted in his body, and from that moment on, his senses operated untrammeled by thought. Elsewhere in one of his books, he says such things as, something is trying to express itself and the culture is trying to push it down. When once it throws all the culture out, then it expresses itself in its own way." And then he adds this quote, "The whole chemistry of the body changes, so it begins to function in its own natural way. That means everything that is poisoned and contaminated by the culture is thrown out of the system. It is thrown out of your system, and then that consciousness or life, or whatever you want to call it, expresses itself and functions in a very natural way. To be yourself requires extraordinary intelligence. You are blessed with that intelligence. Nobody need give it to you. Nobody can take it away from you. He who lets that express itself in its own way is a natural man." And that includes women. You could be a natural woman. Now this person has written in saying, "My question is, isn't life expressing itself in a natural way anyway? All the struggling, all the anxiety, all the awkwardness, anything in fact, isn't that just life expressing itself in a natural way? Isn't my body, my mind, everything already being expressed naturally and perfectly in all of its imperfections? Isn't every man or person a natural man or person? But when reading UG, I start to feel that unless I also have the entire culture washed out of my system, then I'm not really being expressed naturally. All the toxins and poisons of a culture need to be thrown out." Excuse me. Where was I here? All the toxins and poisons of culture need to be thrown out, and perhaps I also need to have some kind of calamity, and only then can I really be expressed naturally. Does there need to be some fundamental chemical shift in order for life to express itself naturally? And if not, what the hell was UG going on about? I don't really expect you to answer that second question, but it does confuse me when I really resonate with your message that we are already free and valid expressions of nature, And then I hear UG going on about having to flush the culture out of our system so that then and only then can life function naturally. And well, it's confusing. Now, this person has also written in again to add, I need to mention in my first email some of the other bodily changes that UG went on about or that others noticed in him, such as very rarely blinking, his ductless glands, which he said corresponded to the Hindu chakras, being reactivated and working to their full, and also having an ability to be awake whilst asleep so that he could recall a conversation people had been having in the room in which he was sleeping. He went on about how these were permanent changes in his body. Superpowers? Maybe not. But I wondered whether these changes had anything to do with the awakening or not. Perhaps they were all just a side effect for him and only him. All right, pretty impressive. But let's keep in mind that one of the other things people observed about UG was that he was a shit disturber and he really liked to confuse people at times. That was his compulsion. So let's see. While it's true that those are quotations from UG Krishnamurti, I would like to read some other quotations from UG Krishnamurti. And they run along this line. Life is movement. You cannot capture it. You cannot contain it. You cannot express it. Man has no freedom of action. Thought and life are one interfluent movement. You are an expression of life, like a bird or a worm or a cloud. Everyone is doing the only thing they can in each moment. You are not one thing and life another. It is one movement, and anything I say about it is misleading. This movement must be seen clearly. There is nobody here talking, giving advice, feeling pain, or experiencing anything. These ideas are simply interpretations that have no relationship to reality. There is no such thing as listening without thought. The very idea of listening is a thought. Even thought is an idea. There is no transformation. There is no psyche. When you see there is no self to realize, no psyche to purify, no soul to liberate, it will come as a tremendous shock. Life is a happening that cannot be explained in any way whatsoever. Life simply happens. Just be what you are in any moment. You will be peaceful when all ideas are dropped and you realize that you function automatically. Existence is all that is important, not how to live. This certainly cannot be transmitted to another. I am just singing my song. If someone listens or not, it is not my concern. What is obvious now is something living, the expression of life. I don't give people what they want. When they realize this, they invariably go away. So those are some of my favorite expressions of UG. I'm not interested in those other expressions because these expressions accord with my actual experience of existence. So once again, just as it is the case with all of the traditional scriptural collections, they're a mixed bag of teachings. They're a mixture of the usual worldly, confused, conflicted views of existence mixed in with what one would call or could call a non-dual sensibility. It's the same with UG Krishnamurti. He would rattle on and on and on from his own personal storylines, but then every so often he would throw in his actual sense of existence, this non-dual sensibility. And that's what we're left with. We're left with his worldly views and then his acknowledgement that those worldly views were all crap. That there wasn't any possible way of explaining what was happening in this moment, that there wasn't anybody in charge of what is happening in this moment, that we're an expression of existence in the same way that a bird or a worm or a cloud is an expression of existence, and that we have no say in it. So once again, we're left with this contradiction. And I can't supply you with any resolution to that contradiction. So all I can do is ask you, what makes sense to you from your experience of life? Is it something that can be described in your particular little stories, or is it a big event that can't be described? Is it a big event that you're not making happen? Is it a big event that you're not separate from? Is it just simply one big mysterious dance? The happening of this moment? Sit down. Make no attempt to do nothing at all. Don't make any effort to do anything. Don't try to describe anything. Don't try to have a feeling. Don't try to have an urge. Don't try to move. And see what happens. Now I'm simply saying, give up all effort in this moment and see what happens. Don't try to do or be or know anything and see what happens. And what happens is, everything goes on happening the way it's been happening. Moving, shifting, dancing. And you will be compelled to act in certain ways. Explore it. It's not a matter of you asking me these questions, ultimately. It's a matter of, what's your experience of life? Now, as far as Yuji's particular expression, all of these supposed biological changes that took place. Some people can do incredible things, or some people's bodies are expressed in remarkable ways. But that's not how most of us are expressed. And actually, each and every expression is unique, ultimately. So that's how no one else is expressed. I've always been very careful about my own storyline when I make these presentations, or when there's this response to the questions that come in. I don't talk about my own so-called personal experience very much, because it has absolutely no bearing on your experience. I will talk in certain generalities. I will talk about altered states of mind, possible altered states of mind, but I'll never tell you about my so-called personal experiences of particular altered states of mind, because that's not going to be your experience. Even if you have strong so-called altered states of mind, all of that is a totally mysterious event presenting itself, and in your particular apparent situation, it's a unique expression. One of the generalities that is acknowledged with a non-dual perspective is that each and every apparent form in existence has to be the unique expression that it is. Nathan Gill has a nice way of expressing this, the bottom line. And actually, I can't really remember exactly how it goes, but he says something like, this is it. This is all there is. An endless display of changing appearances. And nothing other than the way life is now appearing is possible. If separation and seeking seem to be the case, then this is it. If recognition and resting seem to be the case, then this is it. So, it's just whatever it is. And if the focus starts going on the storylines and the idea that we're supposed to be reaching some standard as a human being, it's denying the fact that all of this is the natural expression of existence. It's denying the fact that there is only this great mysterious dance presenting itself as it is. And it's denying the fact that within the storylines, each and every expression of existence is unique. Now, if there's an urge in apparent you to deny those basic facts, that's fine. That's also it. Whatever's happening, this is it. This is the great unformed, inexplicable dance. This is the great spirit. This is the unformed ocean of existence. However it seems to be in this moment, there is only this. And it plays out in whatever way it plays out. So, all of this is simply presented for your consideration. I'm not saying you have to see life this way. There are so-called individuals that I know that have absolutely no interest, that I apparently know, that have absolutely no interest in a non-dual sensibility, and they're just fine. They're a wonderful expression of existence. From my sensibility or from this sensibility, there is only the unexplainable dance of existence. And all of that is its pure and natural expression. So, that brings us to the end of this session. It's a long session. I apologize for that. I will be off for California within the next few days, and I hope that the next month brings good things. However, I know it's going to bring all kinds of things. I wish you only the best. However, I know that there will be some things that don't feel so great. Some of you I will be meeting in California. And for all of you, life is going to play out in whatever way it plays out. So till next time, take care. See ya.